name is Mally Harvey, and this is season one of the podcast focusing on creativity in older age. We're looking at dance, music, visual arts, writing, indeed anything creative. We meet older people in Leeds and find out about their lives. Today's guest is Elizabeth Bardsley, more usually known as Barney, and this is her story of her creative life as an author, a poet, a teacher, facilitator. So creativity is at the centre of her life. This is Barney's story. Hi.
Hello.
Thank you very much for coming
Thanks for asking me to record this.
So I thought we'd start, Barney, by just looking at some of the early times, how creativity formed your life and where it was in your life. So perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, my family weren't really very creative at all, which is interesting. Very mathematical, very scientific, hugely competitive, two older brothers. So quite where I popped up from, I'm not sure. Maybe it was my instinctive rebelliousness that I went a different way. However, having said that, my mum, although she was a whiz at maths, was also very influential on me. So she taught me to read very, very early. She took me to the local library. She took me to the local theatre, you know, the amateur theatre. So I was exposed to a lot of things at a very early age. And I'm very grateful to her, actually, because I do think all of the elements in the jigsaw of my life were put in place quite early on, if I think about it. She loved to dance as well.
And all of those are now very much part of your
Absolutely.
Life. Absolutely. So coming from that background, you grew up, and what happened then? Where did you go? Where did your interests take you?
So I was a linguist originally and went to university in Hull and studied German and Russian. Always very, very interested in Eastern Europe and Russia, and that continues. And then when I came out of university, immediately knew I wanted to be a journalist. It's just something with words. I'd always just written. Words were always absolutely fundamental to me, either in this language or in other languages.
So where did that lead you?
So I started work on a trade journal just off Fleet Street. Now, it was back in the day when Fleet Street was Fleet Street still, and they still, you know, it was a heavy drinking culture, very male, and all of the major papers were down there. And then this building just at the back of Fleet Street where all these trade journals were. And the trade journal that I rocked up on was called Paper. So it was about the paper industry. And you can imagine, I was a language graduate. I hadn't got a clue about the industry, about how to work as a journalist. So I really learnt my trade. There were three men on the staff, all of them certainly over 60, possibly over 70. I arrived 21 with blue hair, that quarter of an inch long, wearing outlandish clothes. I mean, the editor had been very progressive, I think. Mm. He'd obviously seen some kind of spark in me because I didn't have a clue. But I learned everything. I learned how to lay out a page. I learned how to go to a conference where I didn't understand a word of it, but somehow do a news report on it by, you know, obeying those rules of who, what, when, where. I just learnt the tools of my trade. And then after a year, I was so bored. I was practically knocking my head against the wall.
Rather thrown in at the deep end.
I was. And at first it was overwhelming, and then it was just dull, you know, because it clearly I was not going to end up on a trade journal for the rest of my life. So I kind of dropped out, really. I left my father. Well, he didn't know what I was up to, but he was always saying, well, get your feet under the table, get yourself a steady job. So I did that for a year. I've never done it since. So, you know, very bad example. there was a lot of alternative journalism going on. So this is the late 1970s, going on into the early 80s. There's a lot of activism, anti-Thatcher activism, really powerful street politics going on. And there were a couple of underground magazines. So I got involved with one of those and was soon just writing all the time for this magazine. Mostly about the theatre, but about books, about feminism. So there were constant wars on the magazine between the men and the women, and the feminism versus socialism. It was very heady time. And I lived on fresh air, really. Didn't have any money. So I got involved with that. Excuse me. And then made a connection with Tribune, which was the sort of leftish part of the Labour Party. And became their books and arts editor quite early on, really, in my sort of mid-20s. So that was quite a nice break for me. And I did that for 2 years. And then I worked for another magazine called City Limits, which was the breakaway magazine from Time Out, because they'd had some dispute about pay. So I went with the, you know, the raggle-taggle people on City Limits.
It's a huge baptism of fire that you're talking about, with so much variety and I'm not saying argument, but certainly some head butting and asserting things at a very formative time in your life.
Yeah, it was. And I mean, my family are very disputatious, so it's quite interesting that I then found myself in other families, in inverted commas, where a similar thing was going on. You know, you are arguing about everything, really. just everything.
Just for the sheer pleasure
of arguing. Exactly. And a lot of, you know, really powerful personalities emerged from those magazines and then went on and were either in politics or a journalist, you know, radical journalists for the rest of their lives.
So words have been your life, really.
They have.
Haven't they? And that has gone from strength to strength and developed, hasn't it?
It has. But then I kind of fell out with the words, really, when I got quite poorly in my 20s. So I had a really bad time, mid to late 20s. Wasn't looking after myself, as, you know, from everything that I've already said, you could imagine, just sort of living life in the fast lane, and got very sick. And when I was rehabilitating, I started to do some yoga, which I'd never done anything with my body before. Nothing. It was all in my head. So I started doing this yoga and I enjoyed the yoga, but then I felt I wanted to move. So I started doing a dance class, and then that was it, really. I absolutely fell in love with dance, absolutely put the red shoes on, and went off and trained at the Laban Centre, which is it's now quite a highly considered conservatoire for dance and movement in London. There are two, one in North London, and then Laban is the one south of the river. I absolutely, completely changed. So that completely changed my life. And the movement and the dance definitely has informed the way that I write. So I now write completely differently to the way I wrote in my 20s.
I'd like to come back to that because it leads on to a very important area of your life. But before I do, you wrote your first book in 86. Mm-hmm. And was that as a result of your experiences at that time, or was it involved with dance? Flowers in Hell, and a very unusual title.
Yes, it was. It was just, it got published the year that I went to Laban. So it was pre-dance.
Right.
And it was more my radical politics. So it was about women and crime. And Flowers in Hell is a quote. There were two sisters, two twins, who got sent to Broadmoor for fire setting. And a lot has been written about these twins. And they had a secret language, the way that twins often do. And they wrote, and one of them wrote down, "There we were, my sister and I, as vulnerable as flowers in hell. So she was talking about her experience in Broadmoor. And one of them died quite young, but I think the other one's still alive. So it was more a piece of activism, the first book.
Yeah, all right. So then you go into dance, but even that didn't seem to be enough for you. You were always going on a different path, it seemed to me. All of it hugely creative. And by then you found Tai Chi?
Yeah, so that happened. Tai Chi happened at the same time as I did the dance training. So I lived in Brixton for most of the time that I lived in London. And there was a Tai Chi master there called Andreas Dimitriou, who's this kind of fantastic, lugubrious Greek man. And he's very well known in the area. And he's also trained in dance. And I started working with him. And what I noticed was that my body actually needed the Tai Chi while it was under so much strain, doing all of that dance from nothing, effectively. And the Tai Chi was like a soft way to land. And it's the Tai Chi, interestingly, that stayed as the constant for me, the constant movement form. I've done all sorts of different movement forms, but the Tai Chi really speaks to me.
And you continue to run classes now?
Yeah.
So that has been a lifelong...
Totally.
And keeps you centred?
It does very much. And it's also, I have had acupuncture, which started when I got poorly in my 20s. And acupuncture and Tai Chi are absolutely related. Oh, so that whole thing of putting yourself into balance, mind and body, and the meditation, which I do a lot of, it all comes together through the body in the Tai Chi. It's very,
And has that helped you in the difficult aspects of your life?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's a grounding. It's a grounding, because I'm quite flighty, really. I'm all, you know, flying off, as you suggested, in different directions. But the Tai Chi is about, you know, the feet on the ground. Come back to this practice. Just come back to the same thing. Just keep coming back.
And that included the Reiki healing?
Yeah, that's more recent. That happened in 2018, because I broke my shoulder in 2017. And someone suggested that they do some Reiki on me. And I'd been fairly sceptical about Reiki, because I'd heard lots of, you know, different things about it being a fairly charlatan style practice. Well, I was taught by that Reiki that she had a powerful effect on helping me heal from the broken shoulder. So I, from my own experience, everything comes from my own experience, really. So I trained in that because I knew what it could do. And again, it works like the Tai Chi. It's all about balance and using your energy carefully.
And all this time, you've continued to write and do poetry?
It's not really poetry. Although what is interesting, I was saying earlier about the dance influencing my writing, is that I think I write in a fairly rhythmical, these days, in a fairly rhythmical, slightly poetic way, but I'm not a poet. I can't write poetry, no. Too verbose. I use too many words.
That's interesting, because having been a member of your class, you're always telling us to edit, and edit.
Yeah, that's message to self, you see. You teach what you want to learn.
Yeah. Okay. And then you wrote A Handful of Earth, which followed a very difficult period in your life.
Yeah. So my husband, who I met in London, and we lived in London, through a Hungarian connection. We may come back to the Hungary
thing.
Yes,
I'd like to.
Anyway, but he was from Yorkshire. And then he got very poorly, as it turns out, was already poorly with cancer, but we didn't know that. And then for 10 years, effectively, I was his carer for 10 years. I mean, he was very, very highly functioning. So, but it was emotionally, as you can imagine, extremely draining. So I didn't write much during that time. And we had a small daughter, so I had plenty to get on with, really. And then what happened was we moved to Leeds, because Tim was from Leeds, and rented a house that had a garden. And I'd sort of latterly started to get interested in gardening, but we lived in a flat in London, so we couldn't do any of that. And my mother was a gardener. So there we are.
Go back to your mother, roots, we could say.
And then I just completely fell for gardening because it got me out of that, literally got me out of the house. Mm. So there was this, you know, man on his sick bed, or, you know, there was a sort of sense of gloom in the house, obviously. So I just needed to get outside. That's continued, really. Mm. I get quite claustrophobic if I'm indoors too. I hate January. Just if I can manage to get outside, I'm much better, much better, mind and body. Well, I can't remember where I was going with this.
Oh, well, it was the gardening.
The gardening, and the book came from the garden. So a handful of earth. When Tim, the more ill that Tim got, the more compulsive the gardening became. And then I got an allotment, so half an allotment, but that was still quite a lot to deal with. And so the book, which I wrote actually quite closely after he died, so it was published in 2007. He died 2004. So I wrote it 2005, 2006, and it was about the allotment and the garden. And still, it's been out of print for a number of years, but just the other day I got an email from someone saying how affected she'd been by it. People have really... It's really spoken to people, that book in particular, which is very gratifying, obviously.
And a wonderful legacy as well.
Yeah, just lovely to think that your words do continue to have impact.
And help somebody along the way.
Exactly.
So here you are in Leeds with a young child, a widow. What do you do next?
Yeah,
where do you go next?
Well, Leeds Playhouse.
Right. Da-da. So what happened there?
So I was teaching classes, independent classes, so Tai Chi. And I did some work over at Bradford Cancer Support Centre as well, doing creative writing with people. I've always enjoyed, how to put it, so I don't want to say therapeutic, but it's working with people to make art from difficulty. So that if you're in a dark place, there's always a light. And I'm really, really interested in pointing that light, really, or pointing people towards that light. That's really important to me because that's something, you know, that I've consistently tried to teach myself. Anyway, there was a yoga teacher who I knew, whose classes I went to, who said you should get in touch with Nikki Taylor at the Playhouse because there's a program called Hay Days and she might be interested in you teaching Tai Chi. So I did, and then I did a couple of sessions there. And then she found out about Handful of Earth and said, now there's this group of writers, they're quite demanding. Heyday, should you have to be, you know, you have to be organised. I was terrified the first time I went in. So I then started teaching creative writing and did that for a long, long time. Yeah, long time. So my connection really with Leeds Playhouse was originally through Nikki Taylor, and I've worked with her more than I've worked with anybody else collaboratively through the years. And she also does fantastic work with people living with dementia. So I did workshops with her for that as well. Also with Ruth Hannant, latterly of the Playhouse, who did the refugee program, sort of pioneered the refugee program there. So did work with refugees. So very, a very rich, very rich time in my life, just working with different people, but all with all of those people, a similar vein underneath it all, which is whatever your circumstance, what have you got to offer? What, you know, what strength have you got? What creativity can you give to the world?
That's a wonderful philosophy, isn't it? That despite everything that's going wrong in your life,
yeah,
there is something
always
that you can
offer,
even out and do.
Yeah.
And I would certainly subscribe to that in terms of writing for me particularly, for other people as well who find that expression through dance or singing or whatever. So that is fantastic that you can find something in everybody.
Always.
Or they can find it in themselves, probably.
Yes, absolutely.
The Playhouse led to so much else, though, didn't it, really, in terms of your involvement with different organisations? Mm. Can you tell us about them?
Well, the main one was with Alan Lydiard, so the performance ensemble. So performing, which had always been latent for me, really, but had always been, I suppose, a bit of an ambition to, his stage was calling me a little bit. So I worked with him on 3 or 4 different projects, and telling my stories, helping other people tell their stories and getting on stage, also doing some movement work, some dance work, some Tai Chi. So if the work at the Playhouse originally had been encouraging other people's creativity, the performance ensemble was really vital in me shining a light on things I had to say. So that was a very rich time, really.
Was Our Time part of that, the work that you did with Dementia?
That predated Nikki.
That was with Nikki.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Although people from Our Time, specifically Rosa, the wonderful Rosa Peterson, who I've collaborated with a number of times, she did take part in Bus Ride, which was one of the performances that Alan...
Can you tell us about Rosa?
Queen's Hotel. So Rosa is, she's just this shining star of a woman. I love Rosa so much. I met Rosa through Our Time, which was the programme for people living with dementia.
Yes.
Creative programme at the Playhouse, initiated by Nikki. And Rosa came to that and she didn't speak. She didn't offer anything. She sat in the corner. And was extremely reluctant to offer anything at all. And then there was a workshop in which we were working on trying to get people to unlock, you know, things from their mind. Of course, these people were very locked up. Rosa was very locked up, really. Or at least that's what she presented when she was in the Playhouse. And trying to get people to just play, really, with parts of their life. And for some reason, she managed to talk about a horse that she had ridden, that she loved riding horses when she was younger. And there was a runaway horse. So she remembered this story of the runaway horse. So we got her, through using these chairs, to be on this horse. And then this horse was kind of galloping away. And that was, it was like a light went on. And after that, she started saying more and more. I think what's important for Rosa, and I completely understand this, I think I'm very similar, she needs to have really trust the person that she's working with in order to give you anything. And she's very clear about her boundaries. So... But it turns out she's actually extremely poetic and it's got a lot of images in her head, which mostly stay there, but which I suppose I became her scribe, really. And then there was a wonderful thing, again initiated by Nikki, which was a theatre, a whole programme of performances, people living with dementia and about people living with dementia. And the Playhouse commissioned 3 short plays, and one of them was by Rosa and myself. And it was called A Horse Called Freedom, and it was about this runaway horse. So what we would do, it's quite hard to describe how we work, because I'm really not entirely sure. But we used to sit side by very close together, side by side. And I'd have the tape machine on, but I never trust tape machines. I always take notes as well. And then we just start to talk, and then you didn't quite know who was speaking and who, you know, it would just become this loop. And then I would have all of this material. I would then make some shape out of, go away, make some shape out of it, take it back to her. Absolutely everything was run past her because they're her words. I never added any words. It was always completely her words. And then we were, you know, she would just edit it, or she would say, no, I don't like that. And she would tell you, no, that won't do. And so that's how we did it. I've never worked with anyone like that before. Very special. And then we've done that two or three times since then. And because there's now this bond, we can, it's kind of shorthand, you know, we can just zoom straight in. So we did something during lockdown, obviously we're sitting outside, and she wrote a whole fairy story, which if I look at it now, I just think, wow, it is actually full of Jungian symbolism. It's absolutely full. The horse, again, the horse, taking her into the forest, the darkness, helping her to face fears, overcome challenges, and it all comes from her. And she would have to find, there was a special flower she had to find in a special part of the forest, and then when it was all done, then she was led out of the forest again by the horse. And it's as if, you know, these symbolizing exactly what she's going through in her life and how she just has to find the courage to carry on, basically. Yeah, she's a remarkable person.
She still is a remarkable person. Well, yeah. That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's very interesting. I'd love to have heard that, I think. That sounds very good.
Mm.
So you also have done classes in Tai Chi and have continued to do that, having moved out of Leeds into the area where I live now.
Yeah.
And you continue to do your classes there.
I do, at a more modest level, because I'm very interested in taking things easier. I'm very interested in being much more reflective. I think I'm naturally a reflective person. So I do a lot of meditating now, and you know, have a very kind of eminent and fantastic meditation teacher, Buddhist meditation teacher, and I've just been on an online retreat with him, which is, you know, sort of mind-blowing. You'd never quite know what that's about. It's very deep. So I'm much more interested in an internal life now, in exploring the internal life. I've left the razzmatazz of the theatre behind me. And just very, yeah, it's a much quieter life.
You're still extremely physically active, though, in lots of things that you do. And I'm surprised to hear you say that you are much more meditative, because I see you as a very outgoing personality. Yeah. But perhaps that's your front. I don't know.
I think it's both. I think I need both. So, you know, the acupuncturist always says, oh, yeah, you've got to have the yin and yang. So you must have both. So I think that the theatre was very yang, you know, it was very, very external. It was lots of giving out, lots of looking after other people. It's tough, as you know, anyone who's worked in theatre knows that. How demanding it is, takes everything. It would take everything, and then it will take some more. So, you know, and it was tremendously exciting to be that closely involved with the theatre, particularly because that love had started off quite early, and it had been, you know, a long ambition of mine to be involved both with a theatre venue and a theatre company since going to Hungary years and years ago, when I was involved with an amazing, exceptional company out there. So it had been something that was, I was being pulled towards that, but now I can feel the pull very powerfully in the other direction. And it's just about, again, back to the Tai Chi, really. finding the balance.
I mean, you've mentioned Hungary again, and we said we'd come back to that. Tell us about that. Yes, it is weaving a little bit, but I hope you can tell us about your experiences and what has happened, because I believe you've become studying the language, which is not easy.
No, it definitely is not. So Hungary, when I was an arts journalist in London, so just as I was learning to dance, I wrote for something called Drama Magazine, which is now defunct, as so many of these magazines are. The editor was a very fiery Hungarian woman called Ria Julian. And she made the strange move of moving back to Hungary, which was still communist, very shut down country. But she'd been sort of headhunted to be dramaturg at a theatre company out in the countryside in Hungary, which during the 70s and 80s was very, very well known in Eastern Europe for being a very powerful subversive influence.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but you use the word dramaturg. I don't know what that means.
No, it's very hard to describe what a dramaturg is. They're sort of Jack or Jill of all trades, really. So they work with the script. So they're the words, it's definitely words, although they do talk about dramaturgs for choreographers as well, which I found slightly weird. Anyway, what she did was translate texts, which was obviously important for Hungary because it's such a kind of hidden little place. And she was looking for texts, and she was bringing in texts from the outside world. But she then would work with editing scripts. She'd work very closely. Usually they work very closely with the director. So they'd be at the left-hand side of the director and working on script changes. I would say baldly that's what dramaturg is. And she was a very good linguist, and she'd worked in the West for so long. She was obviously an asset to them. And when she went back, and because I'd done German and Russian, I was always fascinated by Eastern Europe. When she went back, she said, I think, why don't you come out? I think you'd be really interested to come out and stay for a couple of weeks. So I did, in the middle of winter. So it was December, oh God, 1988. I got off the plane. I thought, I am going to die in this place. I am not going to survive this. It was back in the day. I mean, their winters are warmer now, like ours, but it was thick snow, nobody around at all. It was total Cold War territory. And then when we got on the train, there were icicles kind of hanging down from the window. I thought, God, this is crazy. And I didn't understand a single word. And it was the most restful time I've ever had in my life. I didn't understand a word. It's just like music. It's like they're singing to me. It's just singing because it is a very rhythmical, musical language. It's a beautiful language. Anyway, so Ria, in her wisdom, said towards the end of the 2 weeks, I think you should teach them a dance class. So I'd just come out of dance training. So I said, well, you know, I can't. But she said, I'll translate for you. She was a very maverick translator. And she used to get bored. So we taught this. I taught this class. It seemed to go all right, although there were some people doing the opposite to what people were doing at the front. And then I'd look at Ria and she'd be, you know, studying her nails or whatever. So it was a bit chaotic, but they liked it. So they said, we'd like you to come back and come and work with us for a month in the summer. So the summer, completely different. It's beautiful, beautiful, beautiful in Hungary in the summer, early summer, June. And then again, I went back the following year for 3 months and worked in two different theatres. One was the same theatre. This is the Csíki Gergely Theatre, which is in Kaposvár, which is in the south west of the country, quite gentrified, quite soft. And then I worked in Miskolc, which is right up near the border of the Ukraine, very brutalist, quite a poor town, really different. I got quite sick there, really different experience, but fascinating. And then I came back from that, fell in love, unluckily, obviously, the way, you know, that's part of it, isn't it? I came back and then met Tim, my husband, almost the following week, because the theatre company came over for a theatre festival, the LIFT, London International Festival of Theatre, came over. And Ria said, come for dinner. I'm staying in my ex-husband. She had a lot of ex-husbands. I'm staying in my ex-husband's flat. And there's someone called Tim who lives there, and he's a very good cook. So come for dinner. So he didn't know he'd actually been volunteered to cook for about 10 Hungarians and me. So I met him through Hungary, really. Yeah, there we are.
No wonder you have a passion for it.
Exactly. And then the wall came down, so everything changed that same year, 1989. So that was the last bit of the communist sort of bastion while I was there.
And running through all of your life has been this creativity in one form or another, hasn't it? That's been the common thread, even though it's gone in very different directions.
Yeah.
And you wrote a book in, 2013, Old Dog, about a dog that you had, I think.
Yes, my rescue dog, Muffin. Actually, it's interesting because people who haven't read it think, oh, a book about a dog. And actually, I think it's the most profound thing I've ever written. It's about life and death, really. So what she did, and people who have dogs will know this, what she did for the family, first of all, we rescued her, but then she definitely rescued us. Mm. And she, you know, became a real companion to Tim. I mean, incredible, never left his side. And then after he died, a real companion to my daughter. And then when she became a teenager and wasn't very interested, you know, in anything very much, she became my companion. So each of the three in that little family, she was a kind of spirit guide. She's a fantastic dog. So it was a tribute to her, but it was looking in the same way A Handful of Earth, the same way most of what I write is about those cycles of life. Mm. You know, something dies away, something else gets born. You know, that constant change, really, in life.
And you are currently writing freelance for The Guardian, for Psychology's magazine, and Female. You're still doing that?
No.
Not so much now?
No, not so much now, no. Journalism is not what it was.
No, it's online mostly, isn't it?
Yeah, it's online. All the freelancers get laid off very quickly. But I'm still writing, so I'm working on a manuscript.
I thought you were about to publish the latest one.
Well, find me a publisher, Mally. Ah. That's the thing. Because even in the last 10 years, so that was the last time I was published, things have changed again.
Dramatically.
Yeah. So it's very hard to get into print now. Very hard.
But tell us about that book.
That's called Dancing with Bruised Knees. So that's about the body.
I love the title.
Yes. it is about the body and illness and loss and what the body teaches us. So the symbolism of the body and then the body itself, really. So because it was an illness that started me on the dance journey in the first place, and then various kind of illnesses of other people, losses of other people. It's about finding the light, really. What is the light in this dark situation? Yeah.
Oh, well, I shall look forward to it being published.
Me too.
But it hasn't stopped there, your creative life, because you've learnt to play the ukulele been part of a group there, haven't you?
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, since I've moved, I can't go to round our ukulele group anymore. But I occasionally join them online. But as you can't do music on your own in your, you know, with everybody else is in the room and you're on a picture on a screen. So I am waiting for a ukulele call from somewhere where I am now.
I know a great ukulele player and I'm sure Pop can find you some group somewhere to
join. That's that would be good.
And you still enjoy the gardening?
Yes, I do. Have a much smaller garden, which actually is a little bit of a relief because the other one was getting just too much. So I have a yard garden now, which I absolutely love. So I've got raised beds and pots, and then very close by, green. You know, there are green walks just across the road and very close by. So I feel very connected to nature still. Right. Yeah.
It's a fascinating story. It's an amazing story about the way in which your life has been a bit like a wandering path through creativity. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to what we've already talked about?
I don't think so. We've been quite thorough.
We've managed to cover lots of things.
I think we have.
Albeit briefly, Barney, because I know there's always so much more to a story than just a brief chat, because that's all it's been, but an interesting one. So thank you very much.
Enjoyed it.
If you enjoyed this, there are more Shine On podcasts to listen to. You can subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can find more fascinating stories on our website in the form of podcasts, articles, interviews and features by and about fascinating older people in Leeds and Yorkshire. Go to www.theshinemag.com. If you have an idea for podcasts or would like to join the storytelling team, contact us at podcasts@theshinemag.com. Shine On is brought to you by the makers of Shine Magazine, with support from Chapel FM. Season 1 is funded by Leeds Inspired.